let's go back to the time of the 70s when there was a number of people claiming to have psychic powers and they were essentially defrauding scientists. And the method was, is essentially this person would say, I can psychically communicate with this other person here. You know, they'd get all the smartest people they knew in the room, and then the two would do their psychic trick. And if it works and they couldn't figure out how it was done, must be real wizard powers. The problem is that doesn't prove that they have wizard powers. As a magician, I look at that and I'm like, well, all that proves is that these two people were able to fool these 10 people.
Welcome to the Humanist Hour, the official broadcast of the American Humanist Association. In this episode, America's favorite scammer, the art of debunking, and fooling scientists. All coming up on this episode of the Humanist Hour. Hello, everybody, and welcome to another episode of the Humanist Hour. My name is Bo Bennett. Glad to be with you again. I was looking for some interesting people to interview, and I was scouring the internet, as I usually do. But this time, I got a link from DragonCon. DragonCon was that awesome event that was earlier this summer. It's kind of where a whole bunch of comic book geeks go to dress up and do some role-playing and listen to different events. But DragonCon apparently has a skeptical track. And I say apparently, I mean, they do have a skeptical track. I say apparently just because I wasn't there. I didn't actually go to it, but Todd and Kim did go to it. So I received a link of all the videos of the whole skeptic track, and I watched, well, I didn't watch all of them, but I previewed all of them. And one guy stood out. One guy jumped out. I said, this guy is a performer. This is the kind of guy I need to get on the show. And I had to bring my A game, because you can't just call a show in with a guy with this level of energy. You've got to bring it all. So that's what I had to do. One could say that the universal forces all came together in creating this show. Because in the past couple days, I've been, let's say, having an invigorating conversation with a few different academics on the topic of remote viewing. This is the idea, if you haven't heard of it before, that you can get into some kind of meditative state and you can go across time and space and view something that might be, let's say, in an envelope, or maybe you could spy on other countries and see what they're up to. But most of the time, what you're really doing is you're just vaguely describing a picture that's in an envelope that you haven't seen. And when I say vaguely, I mean vaguely. I mean saying, well, you know, I could kind of see some circles and there could be multiple things, or maybe just one thing. Or it could be, I'm getting a warm feeling, but it also could be kind of cold. You're probably very familiar with that process and how it actually works. It's kind of the fortune cookie effect. Well, anyways, you would think that this would be completely outside the realm of science, but it's not. A lot of academics fall for this kind of idea, this whole idea of remote viewing. And why do they fall for it? Well, that's one of the things we are going to talk about today. That's one of the things we're going to get into to see how somebody in an academic environment can actually fall for something that many skeptics that have no academic training in this area could look at and say, well, this is a bunch of crap and here's why. But I do want to make clear from the start that within the scientific community, the mainstream scientific community, all of this stuff, including remote viewing, is considered a bunch of pseudoscience. It's considered a bunch of bunk, something that has been clearly debunked many decades ago, something of which the research has pretty much discontinued, and any serious funding, especially from governments, have discontinued in this area pretty much just for lack of results. So it's not like we didn't look for these kind of magical powers. We did. And we didn't find anything, and we move on, or at least some of us move on. There is still a segment of the community, a very small but vocal segment of the academic community, who insist that this type of phenomenon, if you want to call it that, falls into the scientific realm. So that's one of the topics we're going to be talking about today, plus a whole bunch more. So stick with us, and here we go with our interview. And I have the great pleasure of speaking with Mr. Brian Brushwood of the Brushwood Clan. How are you, Brian?
I like the Brushwood Clan. You know, there was the rumored story was that the Brushwoodsmen were a tribe of thieves that were like Robin Hood in that they stole from the rich. But unlike Robin Hood, they also stole from the poor and kept it.
Ah, well, it just had that clan sound to it, so I had to add it there.
We should form a clan. We'll all play World of Warcraft together.
You know, I was thinking empire, but clan just flows better. All right, so Brian, tell us who you are and how do you spend your days?
Hey, my name is Brian Brushwood. I host a little show on the internet called Scam School. We call it the show about social engineering at the bar and on the street, which basically means we teach you sneaky ways to use magic and trickery to score free drinks. I also spent 15 years touring colleges, doing both a skeptical lecture and a bizarre magic stage show. On the magic show, I'd eat fire, stick nails in my eyes, read minds as like a punk rock magic show. And the lecture was called Scam Sasquatch and the Supernatural. It was basically a kind of a greatest hits of pseudoscience and the paranormal and the importance of critical thinking. And nowadays, earlier this year, I hosted a show for National Geographic called Hacking the System. And I have a few independent podcasts as well.
Nice. Brian, have your eyes recovered from all those nails?
You know, For some reason, I just seem to be genetically predisposed to have like really tough eyes. I still, by preference, wear those solid, hard, gas permeable contact lenses, the ones that are basically shards of glass, because even though the soft contacts would be more comfortable, you get more precise correction with those. So I stick to them.
Gotcha. The Coke bottle version of contacts, right?
Yeah, they are really, yeah.
Nice. So tell us a bit about Scam School. I've heard of that before, but I'm embarrassed to say that I've never actually listened to it. So please tell me a little
really
bit more about it.
It's interesting because one of the side effects of shotgunning my career is that people know me for different things. When I'm walking down the street, when I'm at Dragon Con or at TAM, people are like, "Oh, I saw your lecture online. I thought it was really good. I heard you on Skeptic's Guide to the Universe." And whereas when I'm walking down the street and I get randomly recognized, out of everything I've done, the most people know me from Scam School. And each episode is about 10 minutes long. The conceit is that we teach you a bar trick or a scam to score a free drink. And every episode is give or take the same. We have had the opportunity to do some skeptical episodes. For example, we taught how the kinesiology that makes possible the power band scams and stuff. And so we taught those secret moves so that you could sell a magic rubber band to your friends and rip them off. But usually what we do is we'll show a magic trick. Hopefully it fools everyone. Mm-hmm. And these are all with regular people at the bar that we invite over. And then I teach it to them and then they perform it back to me. And so at the end of it, you hopefully have an aha moment. You learn a little bit of magic. And later that night, two beers in, you can work up the courage to give it a try on your friends.
Nice. Now, do you think that has a lot of viewers because it is a video as opposed to an audio? Do you think video has that extra pull from recognition?
That's a really good question, because of the independent podcasts I do, many of them we release both as video and as audio. Mm-hmm. And in most cases, the audio feed is more popular, because I think the nice thing about audio is you can listen to it while you're doing something
sure,
else.
Yeah.
Whereas video takes your full attention. To be honest, if I'm going to credit Scam School success, it's to the fact that two or three years into it, we stopped treating it as a podcast, and instead we started adopting the traits of a YouTuber, where it's like I spend a lot more time answering questions on YouTube. I reply to as many things as I can. We have embedded links that go to other YouTube videos. And also, you know, YouTube is a format that rewards brevity. We used to have 15, 20 minute long episodes when we were treating it like a podcast, because I wanted to fill it out and I was thinking of it as a television show. But as it became clear that our success was coming mainly from the YouTube audience, we made the shows more punchy. We got to the point faster. We don't recap so much, because in the YouTube environment, if you didn't get something, you could drag back and take a look at it again. And I think it served really well. As a matter of fact, as we record this, we are about 30,000 subscribers shy of breaking 1 million subscribers on YouTube.
Wow.
And if you look at the any of those Social Blade statistics, I believe that fewer than 900 channels have ever broken over a million yet. So we're going to hopefully be one of the first 1,000.
Hey, I just broke over 400.
Hey, right on!
Yeah. Thank you very much.
Which, by the way, don't discount that, because it's amazing how everything Avalanche, you know, once you get that snowball going, you know, it's been, what, 7 years for me since I first pitched Scam School and started putting stuff out online. And it's only been in the last year that things really seem to have been accelerating. And it's awesome because you have this, you know, as it grows, you have a platform in order to, you know, express your views of critical thinking, both in popular and unpopular ways.
Yeah. Yeah. That's awesome. Also, you definitely have the charisma to make it work. Actually, I'm having a hard time keeping up with all your energy.
Well, that's good, because I don't know if you can hear my voice. I'm definitely recovering from being laid out over the weekend.
Yeah, you told me that, but you sound good. You sound fine. All right. So how is actually being a scammer similar or different, or similar and different, from being a skeptic?
Ooh, that's a really good question. You know, it was a tactical decision about 7 years ago that I wanted to step outside of the M word. You know, I was a magician, but even then, I never, when I would pitch my stage show, I wouldn't call it a magic show, because when you say magic show, there's a very specific image that comes to mind. People think of 8-year-olds' birthday parties, and they think of rabbits and hats, and like, oh, my daughter loves magic. She's seven. And I didn't want to do that, because I was trying very hard to make a magic show for people who thought they hated magic show. So I would call it, you know, bizarre magic. And then at some point I realized that I'm talking about skepticism, I'm demonstrating, you know, mind reading, which, you know, has its own category of mentalism, you know, freak show demonstrations, you know, magic of the sideshow. And I was just like, I need just a word to go with all of this, because I also had an academic understanding of people who defraud other people with the pigeon drop or the short change con or the found item scam. And I wanted a title that sort of just, it was an umbrella thing. Like, I would be okay if everyone thought of one word when they thought of Brian Brushwood, and that word was scam. So, you know, and understand, you know, I have, here and there, I found myself in a situation, you know, that was on the fringes of the law, but I have really little more than a big enthusiastic understanding from an academic perspective about how a lot of this stuff works.
Right.
And, as far as like the overlap between a skeptic and a scammer, I think the only difference is whether or not the scammer has given it a try. You know, I think that's the same thing, is that a skeptic is a critical thinker who hopefully has an understanding of all the flaws of human nature, whereas a scammer slash magician is exactly that same person, the same level of understanding, hopefully, but just with a hands-on ability to use that for their advantage. Now, what that advantage is, in my case, it's, you know, to charm people and win a free drink at a bar. But for other people's case, it could be defraud them for, you know, $100,000.
Yeah, it sounds like the way you're using it isn't really, there's not that negative connotation attached to it. If you're just like tricking people and for a free drink, it's not like you're robbing old ladies. Or are you doing that, Brian?
No comment. I was trying to think of like, what is my contribution to the skeptical movement? And for that 10 years that I was heavily touring colleges with the stage lecture, it was to tell the story of skepticism. But, you know, then Penn & Teller's Showtime show became popular, and, you know, the words were out there. And I realized that over the last 7 years, my contribution has been to encourage more people to attempt to pull off deceptions themselves.
Welcome back to the Humanist Hour. My name is Bo Bennett, and we're speaking with Mr. Brian Brushwood on scamming and skepticism.
To encourage more people to do magic tricks, because it's one thing for me to look you in the eye and say, no, you don't understand. Your memory is flawed. You're very easily deceived. You know, charisma can cause you to be distracted or whatever. They're like, oh, no, I believe other people, but not me. But it's right. Another thing to say, here's what I want you to do. I want you to learn this magic trick. I want you to go out. I want you to start fooling my friends. Because for me, my transformation occurred when I was 19 years old and first started doing magic on my friends. And two things happened. Number one, I realized, wow, it is way easy to deceive other people. And then number two, I realized they would come back later and they would describe back to me the trick I had just performed for them, and it would be nothing like what I had actually done. So that, I mean, that was when I first had my awakening as to how flawed our perceptions are and how flawed our memories are. And even when I was working at a movie theater, someone came in and performed a short change on me. Mm-hmm. And they ended up walking up with $50 of the cash register's money. And as it was happening, I was trusting the guy and I was following the process. But I remember at the back of my mind thinking, this feels like a magic trick for some reason. Something about the structure of this feels like a magic trick. Oh, well. And only after he left did I realize, oh, wait, maybe I was being scammed. Uh-huh. And so at any rate, my goal is, and if I have a gift or a contribution, it is hopefully that I get more people, more lay people, and more scientists to try, to get hands-on, to experience it from the other side. Because as a magician, you could tell when someone else is running a magic game. You could tell someone else was running a psychic game. You could tell, you know, once you've been there, you recognize those signs much, much better. So the more people we have out there practicing amateur sleight of hand or messing with their friends with a mind reading trick, I think the better off society is.
So do you think it's less likely that skeptics, good skeptics, would get scammed?
No. Oh, goodness. Well, let me see. It depends, because the more you know, a little knowledge is a dangerous thing, right? Magicians, even magicians get fooled. And sometimes if you know how to play to your audience, one of the greatest things as a magician to watch is to go to magic contests where they'll have a 10-minute routine. And if people want to win, they will specifically design their act knowing that everyone in the audience knows a thing or two about magic. So they may design a prop that looks like an off-the-shelf prop, but then does something totally different, specifically knowing they're going to see this, they're going to think that this is how it works, I'm going to blow their minds by doing this other thing. That game never ends. Magicians versus magicians is the highest end of that. Magicians versus skeptics is, you know, it's a little bit easier for the magician, because most of the skeptics may have an academic understanding of, you know, the flaws in our personality or whatever, but the magician has that extra oomph of the mechanics of knowing how to hold your hand in a natural position that conceals a card, or where to buy the right kind of invisible thread, or what kind of technique will cancel out various methods. It's that hands-onness that I think is important, that I want to see skeptics trying out, so that they can join the ranks of the magician and have a few more tools in their arsenal.
Gotcha. So I read somewhere that you scammed your way into the Dragon Con party. Was that a couple years ago?
Oh, wait, which time?
So many times.
They keep telling me that I'm welcome back. It's the weirdest thing, Bo. I in my heart regard myself as a giant fat fraud who happily is dancing around pretending to know something, pretending to be entertaining, pretending to have any value or worth. And for some reason, the people at Dragon Con keep buying it, and they keep inviting me back. So I'll just keep showing up until they all realize I'm a fraud. Which, by the way, was fascinating for me to read about the imposter syndrome. And I'm like, oh my God, that's my life.
Huh. I never heard about that.
Oh, the imposter syndrome? It's a belief that, let me look it up on Wikipedia, but it's basically a belief that you're a fraud and eventually you'll get figured out. And apparently imposter syndrome, there we go. It affects everyone from doctors and lawyers and have you ever had that? Have you ever had that vague feeling that you're a fraud?
That I'm full of crap? Yeah.
Yeah, see, there you go. It describes it on Wikipedia as a psychological phenomenon in which people are unable to internalize their accomplishments. And yes, that's what it is. It's like somebody called me a comedian the other day. And I'm like, I'm not a comedian. I'm just this guy. And then somebody was like, how many number one Billboard charted comedy albums do you have before we can call you a comedian? And I was like, well, son of a bitch. All right. Because on our comedy show, Night Attack, we had a couple of number one comedy. God, I sound like such an ass. I'm sorry.
Oh, that's okay. That's okay. You know, it's funny though, because when you call yourself a comedian, everybody expects you to be funny.
Which is weird, because I don't tell any jokes.
Right.
My entire stage show, a lot of people laugh, and I was trying to figure out why do people laugh, and I realized that one of the evolutionary reasons for laughter is to break the tension, is to indicate that it's now safe, because you hear a twig crack and you look over and everyone freezes with their spears, and then out walks some little tiny, not a tiger thing, and then you laugh, and then that's a signal and everyone relaxes. And by the way, you know, if I sound smart, I'm not. I just read that somewhere. On my stage show, I couldn't understand, like, I don't tell a single joke the entire way through, but people laugh consistently. Hmm. And I realized that there's so many cringeworthy moments of danger that the surprise is what breaks that tension. And what I'm doing on purpose, I'm holding up a little tiny nail up to my eye. And then right at that moment where I'm about to put it in, I make some comment that just breaks the ice, and it gets a big response. And That's all I do, my entire stage show. If you ever get the chance, I think you can see Brian Brushwood full stage show. Just Google it online. You'll see that I'm never joking. I'm just building up tension and then releasing it.
Yeah. Good technique. So you explained before that you didn't want to use the term magician, but you kind of said bizarre magician. In your act, did you ever claim to have magical powers or deceive the audience even at the very beginning?
No. Well, I mean, the whole act is filled with lies, but they're theatrical conceits. And to me, the moment the show begins, mm-hmm. I'm doing a play and everything is fair game. The moment the show is over, it is completely off limits to intimate that I have any special anything at all. Whatever.
Okay. Good.
And so, for example, you know, like a lot of what I do is very tongue in cheek. I try to couch all of my routines not based on wizard archetypes or psychic archetypes, but comic book archetypes. For example, you know, the fire eating, all I'm thinking of is how cool I thought the Human Torch was and the ability to manipulate fire. And so, you know, I build in moves where I'm able to toss flames off of one torch onto the other because makes me feel like a comic book superhero. You know, breaking a 30-pound concrete brick over my head makes me feel like the Thing, you know, this invulnerable being. And, you know, all of the mind reading stuff, mentalism makes me feel like a Professor X. And as a result, I will try to couch everything in a very, very tongue-in-cheek way. I'll say something like, for example, in addition to having bizarre and seemingly useless powers or useless talents, I am, in fact, the world's foremost mind reader. And then depending on the audience, I might, try to contain your excitement or whatever. It's fairly obvious that it's a bit over the top as I'm doing it. But having said all that, there's so many outright lies. I'll say, yeah, when I was a kid, I really wanted to do this. So let me recreate what this was like when I was a kid. And it'll be a routine that I wrote, 2 years ago.
Yeah, right.
It's an outright fraudulent lie, but I think it's fairly apparent as you go through.
Of course, just like all the comedians say, the other day I was, no, you weren't.
Exactly, yeah. And hopefully I'm giving the audience enough credit to assume that that's what's going on.
Right, I think that's understandable. So are there any magicians today, like big name magicians, who are performing and claiming to have supernatural powers, or is that pretty much a thing of the past?
You know, I don't know how many magicians, it's weird because like when you go back and you listen to the old Blackstone radio shows, they'll casually say like, if you're such a great magician, why don't you make a elephant appear in this living room? And without batting an eye, Blackstone would be like, well, I could certainly do that. However, and then it would turn the conversation somewhere else. Like it's there was something about the bravado of the early 20th century magic scene that really blows me away. I'm kind of glad that I don't have to play that game. I'm glad I live in a more self-deprecating, honest age. I don't know of any magicians that would, here's the problem. When you say the word magician, it inherently communicates that you are a liar and a fraud and that what you're doing is not real. So as a result, if you're going to claim to be real, you want to steer as clear from the word magician as possible. We've seen folks like, Uri Geller, who started off as a stage magician and mentalist and then claimed his power was real and then got a wee bit debunked and then sort of embraced his illusionist roots again and then now is distancing himself from them again, as I understand it. Mm-hmm. This is all my opinion. But I don't know anyone. The only place would be where you see the people dancing over the line are when they're doing mentalism tricks, but claiming that they have a almost supernatural ability to read body posture, reactions, to say that they induced certain thoughts due to environmental or neurolinguistic programming reasons. And I think that's where, it's smart, but it's still a lie. And after the show, people are still clearly, these people are clearly comfortable letting people walk off believing that that he was like, oh, no, yeah, he said he looked at how I blinked. And apparently I blinked on this word. And that's how he knew it was blah, 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 blah. He's like, no, he forced that card on you. That's
right.
What happened.
Right. Sounds like they're just buying into the pseudoscience of all these ideas of micro expressions and all these other things that have been debunked or at least debunked enough to get outside of the mainstream science and more into the realms of pseudoscience. So
correct. Well, and that's the thing is if you're cheating, then you can act like micro expressions work with 100% black and white
right.
all the time, you know, right. and are not just a general rule of thumb. And of course, everybody's different and it doesn't always work because right. that doesn't play in a 5-minute routine. It needs to work. And that means you need to force the card.
Right. Yeah, that makes sense. So do you actually teach people to be more skeptical? And if so, what are some of the ways you actually do that?
Well, we talked about how I'm trying to get everybody to actually play the part of the bad guy and, you know, just a little bit harmless for fun. And I think that that sort of total immersion in the role helps people to identify that bull as soon as you can. Some of my favorite episodes of Scam School have been straight up skeptic lessons. We did a memory test episode where we induced a false memory with have you ever done that experiment where you read a bunch of words and then you write them down and usually there's one that pops up that wasn't on the list?
Oh yeah, of course.
Yeah. And so we did that and you know, we taught you know, the shortchange and some best practices to avoid it. You know, really though, I guess I would say that to me, the people I want to reach out to are the ones who are the most ignorant. You know, I could get up and say a bunch of stuff about skepticism and you know, why this thing's a fraud and that thing's a fraud and the other thing's a fraud. But the problem is the only people interested in hearing them that are people who already kind of believe that. You're preaching to the choir. You're speaking to the skeptics.
Yeah.
I want to reach out to the people who are undecided or maybe leaning towards cryptids being real and so on. So as a result, you know, Scam School does a good job of teaching these tools. You know, whether you believe in you know, chakras or not, it's still cool to learn a card trick. So you learn a few card tricks and then maybe it gets you to, you know, think about, you know, the inducement of various feelings that you're causing in people as you perform them. Likewise, one of my favorite independent podcasts we do is the Weird Things podcast that I do with Justin Robert Young and Andrew Main. And that is a show, 1 hour every week we get together, talk about both science news, hard science. We talk a lot about SpaceX and Elon Musk's quest to take us to Mars. But we also talk about cryptids and hauntings and want to do investigations because we live in that space where we don't think that Bigfoot is real, but we do think he's awesome. And right. in the skeptic community, there's this instant like, yes, well, that's fake, so let's move on. But meanwhile, these are the same people who turn around and watch Doctor Who. You know, I don't hear you saying, yeah, like, yes, well, you can't time travel, so let's stop watching Doctor Who.
Right.
Yeah, this instant shutdown of negativity, I think, I think insulates or makes the skeptic community a bit too insular for my taste. So as a result, you know, we play fast and loose with our enthusiasm on weird things. You know, we'll read a story from Pravda out of Russia that is of highly dubious origin. And to us, the question is not, okay, are goblins real? Our question is like, no, seriously. Do you believe, like, could you imagine if someone comes up and says, no, seriously, I was molested by a goblin? And you're like, what would that look like? And then we'll wrap our minds. We essentially are playing Dungeons and Dragons. And as a result, I think we have an ability to reach out to a lot of more undecideds out there who can have a good time and understand that we don't believe it, but we think that this is an awesome, interesting space to wrap our minds around.
Yeah. Yeah, it's funny. I heard a discussion not too long ago on this whole idea of skeptics and science fiction movies. You know, on the one hand, as a skeptic, you could watch a science fiction movie and you could just kick back and enjoy it. You could let go, as you say. You could allow the fantasy to come in, and you could really enjoy the movie. However, there's also that brand of skeptic who tries to apply their skepticism to pretty much every scene in the movie. They look for internal inconsistencies. They look for things that aren't congruous with science. And then they just lose all interest in the movie. And to me, that is just destroying the movie.
Well, and what's funny to me is, in the past few years, we've seen some science fiction movies try really hard, like hiring scientists to say, now we can't be everything 100% accurate, but there's this weird uncanny valley where the harder a movie tries to show good science, the more people from inside the skeptic community turn around and take a dump on it. And I don't understand that impulse, you know, with gravity. I mean, yes,
gravity,
of course.
Right.
You know, people are like, oh, well, those are in different orbits and blah, 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 this, that. I'm like, hey, you want to know what else doesn't match? We don't have a shuttle program anymore. So why? Oh, they can't possibly be flying around in a space shuttle. We don't have any space shuttles. It's like, clearly, this is a different world. This is a different whatever. Same thing we saw with Interstellar. It's like, ah, well, this is wrong and that's wrong and whatever. And it's like, look, I don't hear you guys complaining about Star Wars. Yeah. I don't hear you saying that about Star Trek. There's something about as Hollywood and mainstream media tries to get closer and closer to the truth, something in people who are experts in the truth, it just makes them want to hammer on that difference all the more. And I don't think that's necessarily a healthy thing for skepticism or really for them individually. They should relax and enjoy the movie.
Yeah, I think so as well. And I think a lot of times it's people basically just showing off, just saying, hey, look, I've looked at the science behind this movie and I could tell you that A, B, and C are all completely wrong.
I mean, do you think it's at some degree kind of like they're threatened? Like, well, this is my wheelhouse. And now all of a sudden this rock star is sauntering in to my house? No, yeah. Let me tell you what you got wrong, sir.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, they don't like the idea that these movie producers are making probably like $1 billion on the movie.
Well, and meanwhile, you know, understand, you know, that we have a lot of scientists. We have more scientists now than we've ever had in the history of mankind. But understand also, we ain't all scientists. So even if we get some of the details wrong, the closer to scientific literacy we can get in the general populace, the happier I am. You know, what is it? The IQ scale needs to be reset every 10 years because the average Joe, like 100, you know, most of us would be geniuses by 1950 standards. Hmm. That is delightful. And that is because of the passive science of learning about, you know, relativity or whatever from movies like Interstellar. And yes, they'll get, you know, orbital trajectories wrong or complicated, or they need to shorten stuff or come up with a MacGuffin that theatrical conceit to tighten something up. But I'm totally okay with that. That's the nature of that beast.
Yeah, I think it's also probably due to these online communities. You know, back in 1977 when Star Wars came out, well, besides the fact that I was like 6 years old or 2 years old or whatever, there were no online communities where everybody could go and start talking about the movie and saying, hey, did you notice that Darth Vader's lightsaber was red when it really had no reason to be? It could have been green. You know, they just don't talk about that because there wasn't that vehicle, that medium to actually get together and geek out on these different issues.
Yeah, no, that's been an amazing thing to watch happen. In fact, we just finished a book on the Weird Things podcast that we were all talking about. Chris Taylor's How Star Wars Conquered the Universe is absolutely amazing. It is, in my opinion, the definitive story of how George Lucas came to, you know, it's amazing to see a story in which George Lucas is cast as the brilliant, hardworking, visionary director and to believe in him and to see all the agony of the compromises he had to make. And what a Cinderella story Star Wars' whole rise to power has been.
Welcome back to The Humanist Hour. My name is Bo Bennett. We're speaking with Mr. Brian Brushwood. We're talking about skepticism and scamming. And now apparently we're trashing on the Star Wars prequels, which I happen to really like, but I didn't tell Brian that.
And how he consistently bet the bank on it as it accelerates. And it goes into the, you know, in the 90s as the fan communities start to build. It covers in a very fair way, the rift between people who can stomach the prequels and those enlightened people like me who pretend they never exist. And the acquisition by Disney, it is absolutely amazing. It is, if you are a person who likes the Star Wars story, it is the story of Star Wars, and you're going
to
love it.
Ah, got to check that out. So I want to go back to something we were talking about before. We were talking about how you mentioned Uri Geller, how he is an example of somebody who's been debunked, or you said sort of debunked. I would argue he has been debunked.
If you hear me say weasel words, it's because I'm terrified of being sued.
I see. Okay. All right.
So that's why I'll say, in my opinion.
All right. So go ahead and sue me on this one, who's ever listening. But yeah, the whole idea that there are a lot of people out there, and like Peter Popoff is another one. I mean, people who've been proven, like, look, you have been proven without a doubt that what you are doing is a pure scam and you are a fraud. And yet, despite all this evidence, these believers will just forget about all that. They just ignore it, they wipe it under the rug, and they continue to believe. It's just amazing how something like that could happen. It's
You know what? I don't know if you, I'm glad that you put these two things back to back, because I feel like it has been proven beyond a shadow of a doubt that the prequels are patently awful and terrible movies. We all pretend they don't exist. And yet these people, they just keep insisting that, well, it was kind of cool when Yoda had a lightsaber. I mean, it's all the same thing, man. It's like you ain't going to convince everyone. And you know right. what? I don't even know that you have to, but you can lead a horse to water and all that. You know, our job is to, you know, people think that the job of skeptics is to stamp out ignorance or whatever. I don't believe that. I believe that ignorance and choosing to believe the nonsensical is it seems to be, to me, a biological thing, because, you know, many skeptics, for example, Michael Shermer talked about how he had a blind spot for the supplement Airborne. And he spent 10 years buying Airborne. Oh, I got to get the vitamins or whatever. And then finally had to admit, like, oh, nope, there's absolutely no evidence this works at all. Yeah. We're all going to, ignorance will persist and thrive and survive forever. So to me, our job is not to stamp out ignorance because it cannot be done. Our job is to build a dam to hold back the tide. And beyond that, you know, you can live in this world or you can live in the rational world. And, you know, I'm okay with that. That seems to be what we're built to do. And if that's the best we could do is hold back that tide, then I think that's a noble job for all skeptics to do.
Yeah, I think so as well. All right. Well, I want to talk to you about this issue. I've been dealing with this person for a few days now. I've been chatting back and forth on one of a professional network. She is a licensed psychologist. She holds a PhD, but she insists that remote viewing is real and it's legitimate and not it. She doesn't say it's supernatural. She says it's all based on natural. And she kind of explains it, how bats have an echo signal. And, you know, a lot of justification for this, what apparently and what most people would say is supernatural ability. Now, what I want to talk to you about is this idea of when scientists look at some of these different abilities, these what many people would claim to be paranormal abilities or supernatural abilities, they're not always completely objective. And you probably know that. A lot of the scientists will have a bias, they'll have a blind spot, and they're able to be defrauded based on just their own personal beliefs and their personal biases. So although it's still using the scientific method, they're still using the scientific process, they just can't see what's right in front of them. Now, can you shed some light on this whole idea as a magician or as somebody who deceives people professionally, how this could possibly be?
Well, to be honest, it boils down to most scientists, and this is less true now. In fact, to make this more of a black and white issue, let's go back to the time of the 70s when there was a number of people out there claiming to have psychic powers, and they were essentially defrauding scientists. And the method was essentially this person would say, I have this ability, and I can psychically communicate with this other person here. And the way they would set up the framework would be, you know, they'd get all the smartest people they knew in the room, surround mm-hmm. them all around, and then the two would do their psychic trick. And if it works and they couldn't figure out how it was done, must be real wizard powers. And the problem is that doesn't prove that they have wizard powers. As a magician, I look at that and I'm like, well, all that proves is that these two people were able to fool these 10 people. And it makes sense, though, because scientists are not into deception. They are into truth. They are truth seekers by their very nature. Their whole job, what moves them in life is I want to discover the truth, and I trust the numbers. I trust, these things, the whole trust but verify thing. And if you're completely ignorant of the methods of deception, then by all means, of course, you would be the easiest people of all to fool because, you know, you're smart enough to know you're smart. You're smart enough to think you know how stuff, but you're not smart enough to know that you could buy this gizmo over at this magic shop or two of these, or that this is a classic technique of a discipline of magic that you're just not familiar with. Nowadays, though, I think there's a lot more crossover, and a big part of that is because of, you know, the work of James Randi. Mm-hmm. He introduced this other leg to the stool of skepticism, the place for the shady deceivers to contribute their knowledge of, you know, people who can think like a scam artist. And I think that's an important contribution. And I'm glad to see the bleed over nowadays. I think it is a lot harder to fool a lot of scientists. And I think we, in general, have a much more skeptical population, especially as we move into this YouTube generation where everybody who sees everything is instantly skeptical about it. So I actually think we're headed in the right direction on that one.
Yeah. Yeah. Another interesting observation you made is that Randi really did introduce this whole idea of setting the correct conditions. A lot of scientists, what we have to do as scientists is we have to, when we're doing an experiment, we have to set up the conditions of the experiment to make sure that we get the results, or to make sure that the results we do get are accurate or are valid. What Randi was able to do is he was able to look at this whole idea of the conditions and be able to look at how some people were setting them up and say, no, that is not good enough.
You know, it's almost as though they have two different goals. The scientist sees the phenomenon mm-hmm. and says, how is it that this phenomenon is taking place? And he makes it happen. The magician looks at the same phenomenon and says, how can I fake pulling off the same thing?
Right.
And that's by bringing in an entity that has a fundamentally different set of goals, you see that from a totally different perspective.
Right, right. And what I always think of is that one YouTube video I saw, I think it was Randy back in the 70s on one of the shows with, I don't know, the magician he had 70s style hair, and he was trying to move something with his mind, and he put peanut shells.
James Hedrick? His ability, he would do kung fu move, and then a page would turn over.
Right.
And it turned out that he was blowing on it. And
exactly.
And so he walks out and just... sprinkles some popcorn peanuts around,
right.
and then tells them, you know, if you could do that and not move any of those, you are truly a wizard.
Yeah, exactly. And it's funny though, how when I mention James Randi within a community of people who aren't as skeptical as I am, or people who like to believe this, the mystical and the mysterious and the unknown, they always come down on James Randi pretty hard. And by saying, you know, this guy, he sets impossible conditions and it's unfair. And, you know, it just seems like a typical psychological defense in order to maintain that belief that, oh, supernatural and all this, the mystical and the mysterious, that really exists. And James Randi, he's the fraud.
Yeah, I believe economists call it the sunk cost fallacy, which is once you've spent enough money on something, it becomes incredibly painful to believe that that it was all for naught. You know, if you spent $100,000 developing a prototype for a thing to be so you could be first to market, and somebody is beating you, you're like, no, let's just keep going. Maybe we could compete.
Yeah.
But you're not thinking rationally. You're thinking about the fact that I've sunk $100,000 into this. I can't do it. There are people who have sunk their lives into things, and it's extremely difficult for them to believe that that maybe they were wrong all of this time. And I understand that impulse. You know, that's why you see instant ad hominem attacks, and you see cherry picking of individual stories to cloud doubt or whatever. The hardest thing for people to do is to admit to themselves that maybe they're wrong. So yeah, be like me. Just assume you're wrong about everything, including as you say it.
Hmm. So I know as a professional performer, you are not allowed to give away your secrets and spoil your act. And I don't want you to do that. But can you shed any light on some of the possible things that could be going on when people are deceived by what they believe is paranormal or supernatural activity?
Oh, I mean, to me, that those are two very, very different things. The tactics that work on stage are being created by an entity to deceive another entity.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas most of the paranormal stuff, the stuff that really resonates and that people point to, like, oh, that's got to be paranormal, is oftentimes people figuring out some way to get a random output out of something. For example, recently there was a great story on Radiolab where they told a ghost story about a guy whose parents died, and some psychics came in, and they said, well, the way we contact the dead is we take these flashlights and we unscrew it right to the point where the battery is barely touching. And if you tap it, you could see the light flickers. So then this way the spirits can reach forward with their fingers and tap it, and then and you'll see it flicker on and off or whatever. And so they set this all up. And they lay down three flashlights or whatever, and they're like, spirits, are you there? Spirits, are you there? And then sure enough, nobody touching it, this flashlight just goes flicker, and it flicks on and off. And it's like at that moment, this dude has a bolt of electricity. This is a moment. And he has a conversation. He's like, Mom, Dad, are you there? And one on the left and one on the right both flash at the same time. And he's like, and he has a whole back and forth with yes, no tapping or whatever. And he says it's one of the most important things of his entire life. And then, and this is to credit the fine folks at Radiolab, they contacted a skeptic who says, well, the way this works is with this particular brand of flashlight, it's an incandescent bulb, so it heats up And so the metal expands. Mm-hmm. And so you get it to this point. When the metal expands, and again, I forget the order of this, but basically when the light's on, the metal expands and it eventually breaks the connection, and then it cools off, and then it goes back on again. So you get this sort of random input. And those are the most powerful things, because what you're doing is you're relying on the power of coincidence. Like that moment you get a hit, when you ask a question and you get what looks like a stimulus response moment, that is extremely powerful. And it's one of those, we have a tendency to forget the misses and remember the hits. So all you need is a random noise generator. That's the reason EVP is such a powerful phenomenon, is because you look long enough at some snow on a television, you're going to see what appears to be a face, or hear what appears to be a scream, or hear what sounds like an answer. And those personal experiences, once you have one, it is all you will remember. You will forget everything you know about statistics. You will forget everything all the times that nothing weird happened, and instead you'll only focus on that hit.
Right, right. Yeah. Oh, boy. I'm just having all these flashbacks to all these different debates that I got in over the years, and you pretty much nailed it all. You summed up all the arguments right there.
And this is, you know, not that it's important that you become a genius of semantics, but you know, it has taken me 20 years to learn the fine art of having a discussion about this stuff and still keep a friendship afterwards. It's only been in the last year that I've mellowed to the point where it's like, that might be true. You know, there's this other guy who says this other thing, and you know, are you familiar with this other study? And blah blah blah. You know, and if they are defensive, then you know, I leave them to it. You know, nobody ever got converted by force to anything. Pretty much ever, they got converted by hearing the right argument at the right time to internalize it so that they converted themselves.
Right. And a lot of times it's a really long, drawn out process that sometimes might take years for some people to actually come through and finally admit, yeah, there's probably not this real thing that I thought there was.
Sure, sure. And you know, you got to ask yourself, like, which is better, to have a blow up and, you know, shout, I think this is the truth. And then they say, I think this is the truth. And both of you march off convinced that you were right and the other person's psychotic, or to, you know, build a friendship and a relationship and nudge and have reasoned arguments. And then, you know, maybe have one person understand something at the end. I have not seen anybody get bullied into becoming a skeptic. I don't think that's a very good tactic.
Yeah. Well, a lot of times the argument is that, oh, skeptics, you know, you're so mean, and you're taking away all the magic in life and all the wonder and all the awe. And I just think that is a bunch of crap, because science and nature and everything is just amazing enough. You don't need all the fiction surrounding it. And we do have fiction, and that's a wonderful thing, but we recognize it as fiction. And that's what makes it so wonderful.
Decades ago, Penn Jillette wrote an essay talking about the nature of mystery and skepticism. And the perception is that skeptics are trying to take away the mystery. And he says, no. What's taking away the mystery is you just deciding that there's an energy field. I've decided there's this energy field. Skeptics are all about the mystery. They're all like, no, we don't know why this works. And so let's spend years and years and years analyzing it. Okay, now we know how that part works, but now we don't know how this other part works. You know, the ability to not just decide you're right, and instead to reject all of that and say, definitely don't know. Still trying to find that out. Those are the words of the skeptics.
Yeah, that's a great way to put it. So, Brian, are there any topics related to skepticism about which you're most passionate?
Ooh, man. If you ask me that at different times, you're going to get different answers, you know.
So right now, today, this point in time.
I mean, nowadays, I'm really fascinated by if there's one thing I want everybody to know, is that they shouldn't trust their own memories. That was probably the healthiest thing I've ever done, because you know, you get into arguments with people about how something happened one way or the other. Right. And nowadays I'm just like, well, you know, I'm probably wrong. You know, memory is a funny thing, and you just let it go. And if everybody could adopt that, and if everybody could understand that the least, and I think the next generation, I think the Reddit crowd, I think anyone under 20, 25 gets it, that we're all flawed wetware, and that we shouldn't trust. The last thing we should trust is our own instincts or our own gut feelings about it, or how eyewitness testimonies are the least reliable thing. And we're seeing that now. You know, it's a highly politically charged environment right now where people are talking about police wearing body cameras at all times. The reason this is happening is because as a society, we've started to realize that you can't trust what people say. You can't trust them to report what happened during the car crash. You can't trust them to report what happened during the scuffle at a bar. The only thing you could trust is the hard evidence. And we're moving towards hard evidence. And that makes me happy as well.
Yeah. And as you allude to, it's not about them lying. It's just about the flawed memory, flawed human memory. They really believe they're telling the truth. And they're recreating these events as they're describing them, but they're not as how they factually and objectively happened.
Absolutely.
Yeah. All right, Brian, this has been great. It's been a lot of fun. Can you tell us where you'd want people to go to find out more information about you and what you're up to?
Man, I'll tell you what, I got my finger in too many pies. I will say that if you enjoyed Hacking the System on National Geographic, stay tuned. There should be some more of those. Scam School is over at youtube.com/scamschool. And Night Attack, the comedy show, is at nightattack.tv. There's too many of these. Just follow me on Twitter, SHWOOD. That's Schwood, the last part of Brushwood.
Gotcha. Brian, this has been awesome. You're awesome. Thank you so much for being with us.
Appreciate it, Bo. Thanks, man.
That was Mr. Brian Brushwood, and as he mentioned, you could find him pretty much anywhere on the internet. Just Google his name and you will find him and all the things he's been up to. It's been a lot of fun. If you do have any questions for us, comments, feedback, we'd love to hear from you. Send an email to humanisthour@americanhumanist.org, or alternatively, you can call our listener feedback line at 202-618-1371. My name is Bo Bennett. Thank you so much for being with us. I appreciate it, and we'll see you next time on the Humanist Hour. Bye-bye, everybody.